Takeover. Pirate Podcast Takeover.
Please evacuate this building. Please evacuate this building.
Pirate Podcast Takeover.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. It's Jeff J in Tampa Bay, where it's sunny and warm and never the norm. Big ups to David Happy for opening up the floor here on the Pirate Podcast. That is so much appreciated. And we're all trying to keep our rights from being stolen from us on the high seas, right? From being pirated from us by those enemies on the other ship. I wish they weren't enemies. We got one good egg in there, Kathleen Peters. And she is awesome. Anyway, I'm going to get into it. Basically, it's my reasons are twofold. The public comment at the Pinellas Board of County Commission meeting is April 13th, Tuesday at 9:30. There's another one at the school board. The school board one's more centered around the mask mandate. And the Pinellas Board of County Commissioners, it's I signed up for public comment on masks because they didn't have the option. But then there's one for state of emergency that they have in particular, whether I am against or opposed, and I can speak. So I believe you can choose both as long as you stick to each topic, because I was actually able to do that at the St. Petersburg City Council meeting. I was able to speak on agenda item I-4 and then on agenda item I-5, and I kept my topics separate from each other, and they let it fly. So I got 2-3-minute slots. So I'm going to do the same here. The Pinellas Board of County Commission meeting. Dave has all the info. And that's April 13th, 9:30 a.m. I believe that's at the Magnolia Room on Ulmerton, where the Botanical Gardens is for the Pinellas Board of County Commissioners. And the school board meeting, I think, is still at that location on West Bay. So all that information is available. I wish I had it. I probably should have it, but I don't. But that's what's up. That's Tuesday, April 13th. So I'm going to be going over basically the two items that I plan on bringing up: A, the mask mandate; B, the state of emergency. And kind of a third, I think, topic, which is actually the first, it's on the 3% case positivity. They call that their threshold metric. So what that means in plain English is they want to see that people are testing positive at no more than 3% for four consecutive weeks. And they call that a rolling 7-day average. So again, in plain English, that's basically each day they're averaging the previous 7 days. So on a rolling 7-day average, that is the previous 7 days for 4 consecutive weeks, 7-day average is 3% positive. So my first issue is that is an unrealistic goal. And this is why. It's because their testing procedures, how they test, it's mostly prone to generating what I like to call misleading positives. When I'm talking about, they run what's called a PCR test, and then the other test is called a rapid antigen test. So the PCR test is the main one that they say is most accurate, but they're, I would say, abusing the technology. So when I say generating misleading positives with PCR cycle thresholds, that's called CT, or they call it a CT scan. So that's more complicated to get into. I can actually have my paper available where I break that down more. So to just keep things in layman's English, what it is, they amplify these tests to where they pick up the amplification, or if you want to call it magnification, it's probably the wrong term, but amplification is the correct term, is that they set the cycle threshold so high that up to 90% misleading positive results happen. And so that's because it doesn't just detect a live virus. When you set the PCR cycle thresholds that high, it also detects dead genetic fragments of basically a non-contagious virus. So that is very well documented, again, in my paper. It was in the New York Times called Your Coronavirus Result is Positive, Maybe It Shouldn't Be. And the cycle thresholds that they're running it at is 37 and 40 CT. In other words, the CT scans, the cycle threshold scans, are ran at 37 and 40 and even higher, which pick up dead genetic fragments. So when somebody registers positive, they could be most likely carrying a non-contagious virus, thus not being a threat to public health. But that drives the positivity rate, and we can't get to our their unrealistic 3% positivity goal, right? So what are the most realistic CT scans? It's 34. That's the limit, 34 cycles. And basically what that is, that's 2 to the 34th power. That's a high, really high number. But remember, 37 and 40 CT, that's 2 to the 37th power, 2 to the 40th power. They wind up being high numbers. Anyway, when you do the difference between 37 cycles and 34 cycles, it winds up being that 37 cycles is at about 1 trillion or more amplifications than 34. In other words, it's amplified so high, no wonder it's picking up dead genetic fragments. And where I'm getting the 34 from, it's a well-known scientific fact that when people are scanned at 34, they're no longer contagious and they can be discharged. They're suitable for being discharged from a hospital because they're not a threat to public health, but they're not running the cycles that high. The problem with that is how do we get them to lower the cycles? That's the biggest challenge. So the alternative that I'm proposing, okay, lower the cycle threshold would be ideal. But in the alternative, stop testing people that aren't sick. They like to use the word asymptomatic. And also require a second test, preferably of a different type of manufacturer, to confirm that that test is actually a positive, right? So, but again, you know, if they're testing them again, a second test at that 37 to 40 CT, we're back at the dog chasing its tail. We're not going to get down to that 3% because there's all these people testing positive that are carrying around a dead genetic fragments of a non-contagious virus. So that's the issue. That's one of the issues I'm bringing up, how unrealistic it is to get to that. And then FDA's warned constantly about antigen tests being prone to giving false positives. That happened in two states. Dr. Fauci himself stated in a video that 35 cycles is too high for detecting realistic positive cases. And remember, everything I'm saying, I have referenced in my paper. I'm just going over things real quick and trying to do it in layman's English. And that is about it on that case positivity 3% metric for the threshold. That's an unrealistic deal. So next issue is that prior to the January vaccine rollout, the case hospitalization and case fatality rates, in other words, what that is, a case hospitalization rate is, you know, how many hospitalizations to how many infections, you know, of people that test positive. Likewise with case fatality rates. So, you know, so when we're talking that, remember I talked about that 7-day average, that's a percentage, right? 3%, they want over 7-day average. So when we're talking percents, to keep it consistent, that's why I'm going with a case hospitalization rate and a case fatality rate, because those are in terms of percentages. That way, the numbers are consistent in percentages, right? So we have percent testing positive, percent that were hospitalized that tested positive, percent that died. So the hospitalization is called the case hospitalization rate, that's CHR, and then the case fatality rate, CFR. So the data I'm using, it's a great tool. There's actually some patriots that are professors at Florida Atlantic University. Dr. Rebel Allen Cole had created the COVID tracker along with a professor-to-be, John Taylor. They both are data warriors. Data scientists that use some really advanced software to interface with the Florida Department of Health, and they probably have the best COVID database with all the info. They have the spreadsheets available for you to download, and everything's consistent with the Florida Department of Health. They just used some crazy crazy data crunching software to get all that interfaced and to create really nice looking graphics as well. Powerful stuff. So that's called the FAU Florida COVID Tracker. Check it out. Rebel Allen Cole, Dr. Rebel Allen Cole, and Professor John Taylor did that. And big hat tip to them. We probably should throw them some money because I think they wrote like millions and millions of lines of code. I've had some good conversations with them. But anyway, back to this issue, the second issue. So prior to the January vaccine rollout, case hospitalization and fatality rates were dropping significantly starting in August, right? So in other words, from August all the way to the last really big peak was basically around January 1st. And particularly with cases, if we're just looking at case positivity. So keeping in mind that from, I'd say, September to January, right? So September 2020 to January 2021, the case hospitalization rate in Pinellas County dropped 50%. That's a lot, right? And the case fatality rate dropped 32%. But this is the sticking point, right? They're going by this case positivity metric, right? They're saying that's the threshold metric to, you know, stop the masks, right? So from September to January, that's a four-month window, right? The case positivity percentage that was on that rolling seven-day average, it rose 72%. It was like a crazy number, right? And 72% in 4 months, right? So you would think, wow, these cases went up 72% over 4 months. So, but there's this significant drop in case hospitalization rate and case fatality rate, a significant drop. And then people were like, oh, it's the vaccine rollout. Well, we're talking September to January. The vaccine wasn't out yet, right? Vaccine rollout started in January and wasn't even in full effect. It just started in January. In fact, they didn't even have their heads together on that. They didn't hit the ground running with it in Pinellas County. They had some problems. So September to January, no vaccine, 4 months, no vaccine. Cases skyrocket 72% up from September to that January peak, January 1st peak. But a 50% drop in case hospitalization rate, a 32% drop in case fatality rate. So now, keep in mind, everything I'm explaining is actually in a graph, and it's very easy to visualize, and it's explained with notes and everything. So if you want, you can also email me at floridarepublic@gmail.com. That's floridarepublic@gmail.com. And you can get those graphs, you can get this paper. So everything I'm saying, you can actually see it visually, and it won't sound as complicated verbally. So back to that. So we have this huge case spike, 72%, but this huge hospitalization and fatality rate drop, 50% and 32% respectively, with no vaccine. So wouldn't you think, I mean, I don't think it takes a Harvard epidemiologist to conclude that, okay, we have a case positivity rising 72% while the case hospitalization and the case fatality rate drop. So this validates that a considerable amount of these people testing positive were not contagious with the virus because of the overamplified CT scans. So it stands to reason, like let's look at the opposite way. Let's say if that 72% increase of a case positive rate, let's say it reflected those who were truly contagious with that SARS-CoV-2, right? Let's say that 4 months of the 72% positives, right? And let's say they were really contagious. It doesn't take a Harvard epidemiologist to conclude that the case hospitalization rate and the case fatality rate would increase proportionally, especially when, you know, over 4 months, right? And this is without the aid of a mass-based vaccination program, right? So there was no vaccines, case hospitalization rate and case fatality rate drop. How do you explain that when there's no vaccine, right? But this case positivity skyrockets. It comes back to the overamplified PCR test. There's these people testing positive that aren't sick, especially when it's something like 72% spike over 4 months. That's crazy. And again, I have all that graphed out. It's much easier to understand when you see it. A picture's worth 1,000 words. So when we compare Pinellas with Manatee, right? this is important because Pinellas, they've been these staunch mask enforcers. In fact, some cop basically darn near, let's say a cop manhandled a lady at a school grounds because of no masks. So, you know, when Pinellas is saying, oh, you know, we don't really come down on people that hard for no masks, that's not true at all. They're basically intimidating businesses, and it gives these municipalities a green light to fine and penalize these businesses. So last week, the 8th, I believe, Commissioner Girard said that, like, oh, well, you know, we don't really enforce it, you know, and she tried to make it sound like it's not a big deal. Oh, you know, and we just have this mask policy so people don't get mad at businesses for no masks, which is a really weird cop out that's hard to explain. And then you're not doing it for health reasons. That's what she stated. So, but I want to compare Pinellas, right? Mask enforcement with Manatee County. They abandoned their mask policy basically late September, at the beginning of phase three, when our great governor Ron DeSantis started phase three in September 25th, 2020. So I like to say Manatee started in October because that's close enough, right? So Manatee, no mask policy starting in October. Pinellas, when you look at the graphs, you're going to see that Pinellas and Manatee have little difference in case positivity percentage. And again, this data is gathered from that FAU Florida tracker from both the counties, and I have the spreadsheets available too if somebody wants those. I can email them and you can validate it with the Florida Department of Health or what have you. But so when I looked at the differences, they both follow the same epidemic curve. In other words, when both those counties rise and fall and peak pretty much at the same interval. So one has masks, one doesn't. How do you explain that? How do you explain identical epidemic curves, right? Other than seasonality, right? You can't attribute it to a mask policy because the other issue is this. Basically, Manatee had a slightly higher case positivity rate, but when I averaged the percentage differences, basically a 0.83% higher average case positivity in Manatee than Pinellas. So you have this mask policy where you're really inconveniencing people's major life activities and major bodily functions, right? So you're making people go through all this just to have a 0.83% lower case positivity percentage. And I have all the math on those graphics. You can see it for yourself. And this is important to note. So a lot of the COVID shriekers, these mask shriekers, they say, population density. Pinellas has more population density. Well, sorry if that sounded annoying, but they are annoying. So it's important to note. John Hopkins University, right? They're not exactly, QAnon, tinfoil hat, internet science denier, conspiracy theorist, right? This is John Hopkins University. They demonstrated that higher population density is not linked with higher COVID numbers. Again, I have that reference in the paper. So, and thanks for David Happy for giving me that nugget, because that's a nice little brick in this wall here that's helped me build this case here. So big ups to Dave, Captain Dave. So Manatee lifts their mandate in October, and their 7-day average case positivity over the past seven months, right? It's April now. Since October, past 7 months, an average of only 0.83% higher than that of Pinellas with the, I would say, strict mask policy. So one, no mask, Pinellas masks, and they follow the same peaks and valleys in their epidemic curve. So with Manatee having no mask policy and Pinellas having a strict mask policy, both basically within a 0.83% average. That's 0.0083 variance, right? And they're following the same epidemic curves. Pinellas even surpassed Manatee when they were at that January peak, even went past them a little bit. And this is empirical data. In other words, this is observational data. That's what they call it. It's what we observe. We're looking at what really happened. And we're after the smoke clears, we're putting it all together. So This makes it evident that the Pinellas mask policy, it's of no effect when comparing case positivity averages with that of Manatee, right? We're just talking case positivity averages, right? Since they're using that as their threshold, no difference, and their results are virtually identical. So this is further reason which validates that case positivity percentage is an inferior metric for ending the mask or emergency orders. Pinellas residents' quality of life is being infringed upon with an ineffective intervention. That's the issue, right? So on to the next topic in regards to hospitalizations. So in regards to hospitalizations, and remember, knowing that Johns Hopkins University proves that population density is not a factor, so the Pinellas County hospitalization rate has been an average, again, since Manatee ended their mask mandate in October. I'm comparing starting from that October point when Manatee lifted the mask mandate. So since October, Pinellas County hospitalization rate has been an average of 1.5% higher. And remember, population density is not a factor in COVID numbers, according to Johns Hopkins University. So since Manatee lifted their mask mandate, that's the past 7 months since October. So it has taken now, okay, so here we are in April. Pinellas is actually caught down to, not caught up with, but they've caught down to Manatee and are actually at a slightly lower rate than Manatee in case hospitalization rates. So it's taken them 7 months. 7 months of strict mask enforcement. And so considering hospitalizations are a more serious metric than case positivity, again, we have this empirical evidence, in other words, observational evidence, what we see after the smoke clears. This is empirical evidence that the Pinellas mask policy has made no difference in lower case hospitalization rates than neighboring county with no mask mandate, Manatee, right? It's taken them 7 months to catch down to Manatee in hospitalization rate. So Pinellas is without cause to continue the mask mandate. It's based on this fact that such policy has been proven in light of this indisputable empirical data from the neighboring county of Manatee that has no mask policy. And so there's either close positivity percentages, similar epidemic curves, and Manatee having even lower hospitalizations with no mask mandate over the past 7 months. Figure it out. So the next issue, this is particularly the state of emergency, okay? So I'm getting out of the masks. I'm going into the state of emergency, the next topic that I hope to address the county commission on, ending the state of emergency, because they're keeping things separate. They're keeping the mask mandate. They're saying, oh, that's an ordinance, and then we have the state of emergency that's separate. So I have to, address it separately by default. So there's this document on Public Health Administration, so that explains a cause for a public health emergency is for situations, and I quote, whose scale, timing, or unpredictability threatens to overwhelm routine capabilities. Okay, let me repeat that again. In Public Health Administration, the cause for a public health emergency is for situations, and I quote, whose scale, timing, or unpredictability threatens to overwhelm routine capabilities. So we're talking hospitalizations, right? The routine capabilities of hospitals. So remember when they had like those tent hospitals, like a triage unit, like they were in World War III, and it never happened, that they were worried about routine capabilities being overwhelmed. That's what it is. Our hospitals being overwhelmed, that's the cause for an emergency. So in my research, everything I'm talking about, I have referenced with links, and I don't believe I'm misinterpreting what I'm reading. I believe the reading comprehension is on point. So routine capabilities now in these times, currently, before then, I saw it was like 65% average occupancy. So now they're saying it's about 67% average occupancy. That means on average. That's not counting surge, and there is such thing as surge capacity that happens in hospitals since the beginning of time that goes above the average. So now the target utilization is different than the average, okay? So in other words, target utilization is at what point is the hospital profitable? Are they making money, make it worth running a hospital? So Routine capabilities, 67% average occupancy, and the target utilization I've seen is 80 to 85% on average. And the ICU national average is clocked in at 57.4% to 82.1%. And so in my research, we had that nasty peak July 20th, 2020 here in Pinellas County, 481 COVID hospitalizations. So when I crunched the available beds, the occupancy of the hospital, and again, they keep hospital statistics and ICU statistics separately for each hospital. So basically, you want to count it as two separate hospitals. So the occupancy for regular facilities was 82%, and then for ICU was 83%. So remember, the target utilization is 80 to 85 on average, target utilization, and then the average is 67%. So again, 82 and 83. So what is the issue here? We have a target utilization that's known to be 80 to 85% on average, sometimes 90 even in my readings. But here we have 481 Pinellas County COVID hospitalizations, but the occupancy at that time was 82% and 83% for the ICU. So I had some talks about this issue with, thank God she spoke at Pinellas Community Patriots official, Nurse Erin, who was basically in the belly of the beast in New York during Cuomo side. Really dark stuff there that she witnessed. And she was kind enough to give me a few minutes to just talk to her in private about this hospital. You know, I was trying to put this together, and she gave me a big gold nugget. She said it was because the nurses were furloughed. That's what, so Barry Burton, when he did that sweep, he was talking about like, oh, cases are rising. You know, they had to hire 300 nurses back in July, right? He was talking about that time. So he was giving this illusion that it was because all of these COVID hospitalizations were about to, you know, overrun the building to where we needed, you know, a tent city, right? That was the illusion. But it was really because hospitals were understaffed because the hospitals furloughed the nurses. So we had to hire 287 nurses in Pinellas County right prior to that July 2020 peak, right? So staffing shortages, furloughing the nurses, that happened in May 2020, May, right at the beginning of the basically pandemic, right? So they furloughed the nurses due to elective surgeries being canceled. So this was more so than large numbers of COVID patients overwhelming normal and expected capacities beyond the generally accepted and known parameters that we just stated, right? Which was, you know, 80 to 85% target utilization. That means they want to be running at 80 to 85, sometimes even 90 to make money, right? Target utilization. So, and then that July peak was 82 regular hospital, 83 ICU. So here we are, furloughed the nurses in May due to elective. Why were elective surgeries being canceled? Because the media, the panic, it was insane. They had people, the pants scared off of people. I mean, probably for good cause, because it was May, we didn't know much about the virus. We were all washing our hands until we waited our 2 weeks and they were still pulling that game, right? So, yeah. Okay, so, but Governor Ron DeSantis permitted these profitable elective surgeries to resume the first week of May. And Tampa hospitals received 41.4 million in CARES funding. Tampa hospitals received that. And that was reported in late April. So we got 41.4 million, and I actually have a timeline graph visualized of this that I'm explaining. So, again, everything I'm talking about, I tried my best to break it down, reference it with everything I'm backing up with legitimate source material, and trying to make things graphic so it's easy to understand. So, Governor Ron DeSantis permits profitable elective surgeries in May 2020. Tampa hospitals get 41.4 mil. That was reported in late April, so I don't know when they got it, but I'm sure they got it not too long after that. So let's fast forward to June on the timeline that I have visualized. So at the beginning of June, around the time of the phase two reopening, cases skyrocketed. And so not only did cases skyrocket, a 67% spike in COVID hospitalizations occurred into July and beyond. In other words, from beginning of June, that whole month, 67% COVID hospitalizations spike. That's a lot. Now, in my research, and that I have referenced, this is most likely due to whenever a lockdown is lifted, when there's a new virus out, there's no natural or acquired immunity to it in the population. So, and also coronaviruses are known to spread in subtropical climates during rainy seasons. So we have two issues there. So a lot of the liberal media was trying to say, I don't even like calling them liberal media because they're not liberal. They're not progressive. They're authoritarian, non-progressive, a-liberal, lockdown lunatics. That's A-N-A-L. Put it together. Anyway, so they like to say, oh, it's because he lifted it, phase two and got everybody sick. Well, it's a natural thing. It's known that when there's no natural acquired immunity, and then what? There's problems with that unemployment system. There's no unemployment money. He had to make a decision. Not everybody's a rich white liberal that's cronies with Rick Christman, right? So pursuant to, remember, 67% spike in June. That's real important, right? Elective surgery start in May. COVID money, 41 mil. 67% spike June through July. So we've got, July 3rd through July 4th, 2020, I got some communications through a document request from Pinellas Emergency. I was asking about the 287 nurses that got hired. You know, what record do you have of how many nurses went to which hospital? So it turns out HCA and BayCare are the two biggest hospital brokers here in Pinellas. So in this document request, BayCare, this is on July 3rd and July 4th. So think about this. The cases spiked that whole month of June, right? And now they're asking for nurses in early July. So they got basically that elective, you know, barring a forensic investigation into their books, right? What I'm seeing with publicly available information, 41.4 mil beginning in May, elective surgery is resumed. So you're getting that elective surgery money in May, all the way through June, still doing it all the way through June, you know, so May through June, 2 months of that. And then July 3rd, you're asking for nurses, but the hospitalizations were spiking 67% for that whole month, and now you're asking for nurses July 3rd and 4th, right? So, okay, think about it. So BayCare requests 60 RNs, and HCA, under the direction of Larry Feynman, and I guess Lisa Johnson is with BayCare. So BayCare gets 60 RNs or requests 60 RNs. HCA requests 120 registered nurses and 50 licensed nurses under the direction of Larry Feynman. So that's basically 230 of the 287 of the staff that was reported by the paper, right? That was hired in late July. So now this is crazy. And everything I'm explaining, again, I have it graphed in a timeline that's visual with notes. So HCA follows up with their request 8 days later on July 12th. So July 3rd, after COVID hospitalization spike 67% for a whole month, June through July, you're getting that elective surgery and CARES money starting in May. So that's 2 months of gravy. But the cases start, but now you're asking in July 3rd, oh, well, something's going on with the paperwork. HCA follows up 8 days later on July 12th, 8 days. And COVID cases are spiking each day. I don't know. Think about it. But so with that publicly available information gathered for now, it appears that 67% spike in COVID hospitalizations through the entire month of June, before the two biggest hospital chains made the decision in early July to request nearly 250 travel nurses to keep up with the demand. Okay, so I can only conclude that, you know, only skeleton crews of nurses were pushed to their limits for a full month with backed up elective surgeries that are occurring at the same time with the influx of COVID cases, which multiplied before HCA and BayCare finally asked for help a month later. It's just food for thought. Now, again, you might have to rewind what I'm saying, but it's a lot easier to see when you visualize it. So that's what I'm saying. Basically, all the information I have now, from what we see, this 67% spike for a whole month through June, these two biggest hospital chains make this decision early July, a month later, to ask for 250 nurses, right? So they must have had skeleton crews of nurses being pushed to their limits for a whole month, you know, even from, you know, with these backed up elective surgeries, and then these 67% spikes in June, they were being pushed to their limits in June. They had to have been. So since elective surgeries were permitted in May, since federal relief money for furloughed nurses, and that's what they said it was for furloughed nurses, right? Since it may have been received by the hospitals at or around such time around May, then with this publicly available information, it's demonstrating that for now, you know, barring a forensic investigation of their books, these hospitals could still have run at a profit May through July with some regular staffing without as many furloughs, which caused the staffing shortages prompting these last-minute requests for 230 nurses in early July after that obvious 67% increase in hospitalizations was realized through that entire month of June prior. And again, this is a lot easier to understand when you see it in the timeline. So that's an issue right there. So, you know, they're trying to say, oh, well, you know, like Barry Burton, again, I'm going back to him. He was given this illusion that, you know, we had to hire those 300 nurses, you know, because of the spikes, but they weren't bringing up this thing about the furloughs, the elective surgeries resuming, the $41 million in CARES. Could the hospitals have ran at a profit with the CARES funding and all that and had a normal crew to their, where they weren't pressed? And again, at that nasty peak, the hospitals were at 82% regular, 83%, and target utilization is 80-85. So, I don't know. You tell me. And it'd be great if we could have a rational discussion with this, with the leaders, but evidently they just give us 3 minutes of fame. And, I mean, are we going to have to press for a class action lawsuit with business owners, with citizens crowdfunding a class action lawsuit against the county? Let's subpoena Dr. Cho of Florida Department of Health. Let's put them all under oath, right? Let's subpoena those books from the hospitals to see if they could have ran at a profit, huh? Think about it, folks. So, you know, are we going to have a rational discussion? Or are we going to have to, like, file a class action lawsuit, survive that motion to dismiss, and then have depositions, put them under oath, and do discovery and interrogatories? Or can we have a rational discussion in public somewhere? It'd be great. So anyway, I'm moving on. I'm still staying on the hospitalization issue, being overwhelmed, but into a different light. All right, so I gathered some hospital data from the AHCA. Some of you, actually the crowdfunding for that went great. It really helped. So I got hospital averages. I got a lot of data from them. And I did a basic crunch. So 2015 through 2019, broken down by quarter one, quarter two, quarter three, quarter four. So the COVID in 2020 happened in quarters two and three. So in other words, that's... I guess quarter one's January, February, March. Quarter two is April, May, June. And quarter three is July, August, September. So that peak really was quarter three. That's the big test. So on average, from 2015 to 2019, on average, hospitalizations were at basically about 30,000 total. Like when you add up quarter two and quarter three hospitalizations for 2015 through 19, averaging about 30,000. When you averaged the, actually, it may have been more. I think it was at like 38, maybe. I think that's what it was, actually. I need to look it up again. But I have this on a graph, and you'll see that quarter two and quarter three hospitalizations were abysmally lower discharges. And again, that probably comes down, you know, people are scared to go to the hospital. Hospitals are understaffed because of the furloughs. But where does it start? It starts with media-induced panic, scaring the pants off of people from going to the hospital. Crazy. So we have this, you know, quarter two through quarter three covering basically that nasty peak in, you know, most of our hospitalizations that we've ever seen. We haven't seen hospitalizations on the level yet. The last peak was in January. It was like 396, right? So, yeah, in fact, January 14th, 2021, there was a 396 COVID hospitalization census. That was our second peak. Okay, so that basically it puts facility occupancy at 80% and ICU occupancy at 91. So the ICU was definitely up there. I don't know how much of it was COVID ICU. I have no idea. But total facility occupancy was at that target utilization rate between 80 and 85, right? Now, let's think about this. October through April is snowbird season. We're used to seeing hospitalizations, ICUs filling up. So for nearly 20 years, we've known this. I got a 2003 document. Flu season in Florida typically occurs between the same months of snowbird season. Peaks in January through February, we're used to seeing that. On average, quarter one hospitalizations are actually the highest when you look at the data that I found. It's upwards of like 40,000 hospital discharges, right? And we have yet to get quarter one 21 data and quarter four 2020 data is available in May. So I can't get that data yet. But typically, quarter one hospitalizations, that's January through March, are high. 40,000 on average. So, and snowbird season's October through April. So, this document that I got, a hospital document, it's saying that we, you know, that causes hospitalization spikes October through April because of snowbird season and flu season. It runs concurrently. So, it's not abnormal to see 40,000 hospitalization discharges quarter one. So, the conclusion, the information herein demonstrates that hospitals in Pinellas County were never overwhelmed in either the July or January peaks to the point of a definitive, remember what we said was a public health emergency? When routine capabilities are overwhelmed, right? So there was no point of a definitive public health emergency from COVID patients ostensibly, that means presumably, exceeding the known expected and or routine facility capacities that we normally expect, right? Remember that 80 to 85 target utilization, right? Hospitals experience capacity problems due to the decision-making of hospital business administrators. The furloughs happened in May, yet hospitals were permitted to resume their profitable elective surgeries through the beginning of July, while likely receiving that $41.4 million in CARES Act funding. The 67% upward hospitalization trend in June towards the July peak was not acted upon by HCA and BayCare, who instead hired travel nurses in July after an entire month of that 67% spike in cases in hospitalizations. So the 11th hour decisions on the part of HCA and BayCare should not constitute an emergency on the part of Pinellas County residents, and the Pinellas Board of County Commissioners should cease the state of emergency due to the routine capabilities of the area's hospitals not being under any imminent threat of being overrun with COVID patients. And that's the issue. So the harms and effectiveness of mask use outweigh the perceived benefits, and they fail at the five known criteria, what's known as a bona fide public health emergency. And that's, I probably need to do another bit on that because I'm coming up on 45 minutes and we got to keep it like that. Big ups to Dave Happy of the Pirate Podcast. Thanks for having me on as a guest. And y'all stay strong out there. Stay strong because we need each other in numbers, power in numbers. And this is, we're at the tipping point right now to where things can go either way and we need to keep pushing it. All right, Patriots. And come out to a community, Pinellas Community Patriots official meeting sometime and check us out on Facebook. There's a website. And we are getting really active. And we have recently merged with Defend Florida. So things are picking up. And we want to see more of you out there. We want to see some of you all running for office, for school board. And let's do this thing. Later.
This has been a Pirate Podcast Takeover. We now resume our normal programming.